it doesn't make people feel nervous. Well, good morning. Welcome to Narkees. March 4th, 2017. So, we are looking at small sections of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. In Jesus' day, they would read through those five books until they got to the end and start over. And it probably took then about 3 years. So we've been following a similar pattern. And each little section is connected to a section in the prophets. So that's what we're doing. These passages. Okay. So was everyone here this morning, here last week?
Last week.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you see, so we're continuing Exodus 26. It's about the tabernacle. Some things in the tabernacle. Furnishings. Shalom Amos Leboaz. Okay, I have to. So we're continuing the Mishkan readings, the tabernacle readings. And there are several things. It's a short selection we have this morning. So the connection, these two were connected in ancient days. So probably in Jesus' time, people were already making a connection between this passage and this passage. And so we like to follow in, kind of imagine what Jesus and his disciples would talk about when they discussed connecting these two passages. But now for us, we also have the New Testament, so we might also go on and see some connections there as they apply. So first things first, we will read Exodus 26, the last couple verses there, until chapter 27, 19. So maybe Gemma will start with you. If you have English, keep reading. If not, we can skip to whoever is reading English. And the rest of you can follow. If you're not reading English, we're reading this part. Okay, Gemma, go ahead and read a couple verses for us.
Make a curtain of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and fine twisted linen with cherubim woven into it by a skilled worker. Hang it with gold hooks on four posts of acacia wood overlaid with gold and standing on four silver bases. Hang the curtain from the clasps and place the Ark of the Covenant Law behind the curtain. The curtain will separate the holy place from the most holy place. Put the atonement cover on the Ark of the Covenant Law in the most holy place. Place the table outside the curtain on the north side of the tabernacle and put the lampstand opposite it on the south side.
And for the entrance to the tent, make a curtain of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer. Make gold hooks for this curtain and five posts of acacia wood overlaid with gold, and cast five bronze bases for them.
Make it all for acacia wood 4 1/2 feet high. It should be square, 7 1/2 feet long and 7 1/2 feet wide. Make each of the four corners of the altar stick out like a horn in such a way that the corners with their horns are all one piece. Then cover the whole altar with bronze.
You shall make its bows to clear its ashes, its shovels, its basins, its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all its vessels of copper. You shall make for it a netting of copper meshwork and make upon the meshwork four copper rings at its four
who's next? Do you want, no? Do you want to read over there, Danny?
Oh, what were you
doing? Nine.
Nine.
27.
You shall make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side, there shall be hangings for the court made of fine woven linen, 100 cubits long for one side. And its 20 pillars and the 20 sockets shall be bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands shall be silver. Likewise, along the length of the north side, there shall be hangings 100 cubits long with its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of bronze and the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver.
12. Mm-hmm.
And along the width of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits with their 10 pillars and their 10 sockets.
Go ahead.
On the east end toward the sunrise, the courtyard shall also be 50 cubits wide. Curtains 50 cubits long are to be on the side of the entrance with three posts and three bases, and curtains 15 cubits long are to be on the other side with three posts and three bases. For the entrance to the courtyard, provide a curtain 20 cubits long of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer, with four posts and four bases. All the posts around the courtyard are to have silver bands and hooks and bronze bases. The courtyard shall be 100 cubits long and 50 cubits wide, with curtains of finely twisted linen, 5 cubits high, with bronze bases. All the other articles used in the service of the tabernacle, whatever their function, including all the tent pegs and all those for the courtyard, are to be of bronze.
Nice. So there we go. That's our selection. Very technical. If we aren't the ones building this, it's hard to find what would be relevant to us. But as you think about it, you may still find something.
I've got a question.
Okay. Does it relate to this?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
I'm not clear about the difference between bronze and brass or copper. You had...
He had bronze. Copper.
You had copper.
Yeah.
I've got... Bronze.
I have bronze.
And I can't remember what...
one is...
Brass and something, or is
bronze is harder, right? It's an alloy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's got... They've got mostly the same ingredient, but bronze has another... It has iron or something added in to make it harder.
Bronze does.
Bronze is harder than copper. Mm-hmm. But it's the same basic element.
What's brass, then? I get very confused.
It's also... I do as well, but it's also an alloy.
What's the word that we get as bronze or here in Hebrew?
Nechoshet.
Bronze is a darker color, copper is lighter.
I know, I mean, I've got...
Nechoshet is your base material. Now, when you mix it with a little bit of another metal, it might make it stronger. But they refer to it as what the majority is. So nechoshet in some context could be copper. In most, I think they would be bronze. I don't know why your translation wanted copper there. But it is true, all of the utensils here are made to carry, right? People have to carry them from place to place. So if bronze is heavy and you're covering everything with it, then the end result could be a very heavy thing.
And also the earlier on, you're covering with gold.
And it could be that the reason they thought copper is better is it's a little bit lighter. And so if you cover it with copper, maybe it's easier to carry. However, the altar also has to withstand heavy heat. So I don't know how much heat a copper could withstand compared to bronze. I'm thinking maybe bronze would be stronger. But I don't work in metal work, so I don't know.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Hello.
Find a seat.
Hello.
Hello.
Bronze is an alloy consisting primarily of copper, 12% tin, and often with the addition of other metals, aluminum, manganese, nickel, or zinc.
Right.
And sometimes non-material.
Right. And brass is also an alloy. Alloys, anytime you don't have a pure metal, you're mixing in a little bit of something else. And usually the intent to mix it in is to make something stronger. Their combined characteristics are stronger.
But bronze is not mixed. Is bronze an alloy?
Yes. She just read what it could be mixed of.
Oh, what did you read?
The majority is copper, and you can mix in little bits of manganese, zinc, tin.
Are you just looking it up on Google?
Yeah, I was If they use it for a long time, the bronze will be stronger.
Right, so bronze, if you have a stronger metal, it lasts longer. That could also be. And you notice all the utensils are going to be used with fire, too. They're going to be very hot, and they'll be used a lot. So those things are meant to be used made of nechoshet.
Quality. The better the quality, I mean, the embroidery has to be first class.
Well, sure.
Everything gold has to be there. So it's always this super quality for the mishkan.
Definitely super high quality. Let's think about these materials. For those who just entered, we're talking about the tabernacle, a passage on the tabernacle, and we will connect it to this passage in Ezekiel. That connection was made by people way back in Jesus' day. We didn't make that connection, but we want to think about it and understand those two passages together and what they can say, how they help us interpret each other, or how they help us interpret the two texts. So what are some of the materials that you keep hearing from the beginning of this selection? We just talked about bronze, so I'm going to put bronze up. What else?
Silver.
Silver.
The repetition of the backwards.
Okay, bronze I put with copper because in Hebrew it's both nechoshet. For anyone who speaks Hebrew, that's the word, nechoshet. Okay, kesef. What else?
The repeated materials. What else? The scarlet.
Okay, there's
blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and finally twisted leather.
Okay, what you call purple is al-yaman. Blue is a bright blue, treret. And scarlet you called, that's shani. These dyes were made from various animals, certain snails. You crush the shell, and they give you agaman. A different snail or different worm gives you shani, the scarlet. And also trelet is yet another. And so depending on the animal or the shell you're crushing, depends what color you get from it. These are dyes. In ancient days, it would be very expensive to make dyed fabric. So, by definition, the people who would have access to these are high society people. Also kings. Kings, temples, palaces, these are the places that you would see these types of materials. If you go to someone's house, their clothes will not be fancy unless they're very high in society, very rich people. Acacia wood.
We missed out gold.
Yes, chitin. Acacia. Yeah, I was expecting something to say gold in here.
I did.
Zahav. Silver and gold often go together. Acacia. Chitin. It's also supposed to be a very durable wood. For the altar, it specifies that it should be hollow.
Hollow.
Hollow inside. And again, we talked about this is an altar that we are going to carry. Four people, or I don't know if more than four people, but there are two poles through the altar. It needs to be carried.
Hollow acacia?
There's a place in our text where it says to use hollowed wood. I don't know, like if you take a pole and take out the middle of it to make it lighter, maybe?
Carpenters can do that pretty easily.
A skilled carpenter can do that, yes. Thank you. I have a hoarse voice today, so we'll see how long my voice lasts.
But acacia is it so big? It seems like I'm just thinking of a small.
Well, you would use a big trunk. Apparently, it is quite a hard wood. It's quite durable. And I think everything made out of wood is acacia in the tabernacle. So it's very strong wood, durable.
It's a desert tree.
It's a desert tree too. Now, we didn't get any leather in this passage, did we?
I don't think so. I had it last week.
But last week we had it. Did you discuss what kind of leather?
I wasn't here.
Did you discuss
that
it?
With badgers and things like that.
A little bit, yeah.
Badgers?
Badgers.
Seals.
Tehachim. It's either a dolphin or a porpoise, which is like a dolphin.
But, yeah.
They're not quite as intelligent.
But what?
What does it have to do?
Are we for sure it's that?
Predictable.
This is how the early translators
in
Aramaic
and also
interpreted.
Greek too, right?
In Greek, I forget. Possibly.
Sea lions?
And maybe the Greek didn't have precise. No, it should have.
Know
Dolphine.
Does everyone know what a porpoise is from other cultures?
Porpoise.
This word porpoise in English, do you know dolphin? It's related. The dolphin's head is like this. Sorry. And the porpoise is more just like that.
I'm very impressed. Too many kids.
What?
She knows the difference.
And then a porpoise has like a triangle something, and a dolphin is more like this.
They're both mammals.
They're both mammals. They're very similar.
So a resident sea artist here. Very good.
And they both, there are many in the Red Sea. So if you're coming in that area, you would be able to find this animal. And presumably their leather would be good. It may have a little bit of protection against rain as well, which would be good. If you're out and exposed in the open, you want your leather to be kind of waterproof. So this word is not in our text this week, but it's been previous. And it's going to be in our Ezekiel text, so I bring it up now. We'll talk a little bit about it. Okay, so what else? That's a pretty good idea. Oh, we're missing one. Linen, fine linen. This is white. It's been specially made white. And here is the word shesh.
Is it flax?
It's flax is made into linen.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a kind of a plant. Flax is made into linen. So in Hebrew we have a word shesh. And it says fine white linen. It would be a very fancy white fabric. And it is also the same word in other places as botz. Botz is a later word. Shesh is an earlier word. This one is probably from an Egyptian word, and this is from some kind of a Semitic word, more, you know, the Babylon area. Not in the Bible.
Not in the Bible.
Well, I mean, it can be, but not this boots. Boots. But it's they're not related. You often have words that look the same, but they're not related.
Right.
It's just like a chance. They came from different roots. Boots. Sorry, I'm saying it wrong. It's boots and shesh. So, every time you hear these ingredients, you should be thinking of what?
Wealth.
Wealth.
Status.
Royalty.
Basically, royalty and temples. Palaces and temples. Every time you see these ingredients, you think palace, temple. Certain things are, you think tabernacle. This one is not from the temple. It's leather. It's a leather cover for a tent. This one is the tabernacle only. I'll put tabernacle. But fine linen, scarlet, blue, purple, silver, gold, bronze. Those would be palace and temple. So now, with this in mind, I want us to read our next prophetic section in Ezekiel 16:10-19. Now, in Ezekiel, we have a passage where God is speaking to Israel as if she were a young girl. And it starts before our verse 10. It describes this little baby that was abandoned and had nothing, just completely left in its blood. And it's a famous passage. It says that God crossed by and said, "Live in your blood, live in your blood." And then she grows up and she becomes mature. And then God passes by again and gets engaged and marries her. And then our passage starts when in this process of getting married. So Ezekiel 16, verse 10, maybe David Bogenrief, do you want to start reading for us?
Nine looks like it goes best. "And then I bathed you with water and washed all the blood off you. I put oil on you. I put beautiful clothes made with needlework on you and put sandals of fine leather on your feet. I wrapped you in fine linen and covered you with silk. I put jewelry on you, bracelets on your arms, a necklace around your neck, a ring in your nose, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head." 13?
Go ahead, sure.
Go ahead. "So you wore gold and silver. Your clothes were made of fine linen, silk, and beautiful needlework. You are fine flour, honey."
You ate. Ate the finest flour?
"You are fine flour." You ate. Okay.
Ate, yeah.
You, that explains it better. "You were very beautiful and became a queen. Then you became famous among the nations because you were so beautiful. Your beauty was perfect because of the glory I gave you, says the Lord God." Living Bible.
Okay. And Gemma, can you finish off those verses? Verse 15 to 19?
"But you trusted in your beauty and used your fame to become a prostitute. You lavished your favors on anyone who passed by, and your beauty became his. You took some of your garments to make gaudy high places where you carried on your prostitution. You went to him and he possessed your beauty. You also took the fine jewelry I gave you, the jewelry made of my gold and silver, and you made for yourself male idols and engaged in prostitution with them. And you took your embroidered clothes to put on them, and you offered my oil and incense before them. Also the food I provided for you, the flour, olive oil, and honey I gave you to eat, you offered as fragrant incense before them. This is what happened, declares the Lord."
Okay. So it's quite a powerful metaphor, a word picture that he's using. And did you catch some of these materials?
No.
What materials do you see here that are the same with the tabernacle?
Fine linen.
Fine linen, yes, definitely.
Tahash leather.
Tahash, the leather, the fine leather, is actually the word in Hebrew is tahash. It's this word for the porpoise skin or dolphin skin. And the only places in the Bible that this leather comes, besides this passage, are describing the tabernacle. There's one place where tahash is a name of somebody. But besides that, that's a... Genesis 22:24. Tahash is a name. But in every other passage, it's describing the covering of the tabernacle. So here, when Ezekiel says, "I made you sandals using this tahash," he expects you to think about the tabernacle. Now you're understanding that this woman Israel is also being connected to worshiping God in the tabernacle, because all these elements are that she's wearing are similar to what was done in the tabernacle. So we have tahash. What else do we have?
Silver and gold.
Silver and gold.
Linen, silk.
Okay, the word silk is particular to Ezekiel. It's actually not necessarily silk. Today, it's a word meshi. Today in Hebrew, we call it silk. But in the Bible, we don't know. It was a fine linen, fine fabric. We don't know which exactly fine fabric it was. But probably also colored, because colored fabric is much more expensive.
Also, a beautiful finished clothes. That was the same in the tabernacle. They must be beautiful down.
They must be beautifully finished. That's right. That might be, you're looking at the word rikma. Rikma is embroidered.
Yeah.
Needlework. Where you make many colors, you weave them together to make pictures. This is a word, rikma. It's in Ezekiel. We call it embroider. Or embroidery. That word.
Define embroider.
Embroider is with the needlework, or putting many strings of thread together to make a picture. You can do little
or design. Could also be a design.
Or,
not just
yeah, design something pretty with colors designed. We don't have the word rikma, but we have the person who does this mentioned in our text, the rokem. The work of an embroiderer. So that is also connected. And all the things in the tabernacle were meant to be beautiful, and embroidery work was there. Specifically, what was meant to be embroidered? Do you remember at the beginning of the Exodus passage? There was one picture that they mentioned. It's actually a creature that they want.
Oh, the cherubim.
Cherubim. We talked a bit about a cherub. There's a statue of a cherub from, I'm assuming, somewhere in Babylon or Assyria. I don't know which. A cherub is an angelic creature that's a combination of animals, different features. Some have human heads, not all of them. They usually have wings. They're strong. They're the ones that guard things, like gates. We talked about the Garden of Eden. God said kulvim, this word for cherubim.
Different than the seraphim?
Yes. Seraphim are serpents. Serpents with wings. They are also an angelic being, but a different shape. So these are kind of more, I don't know, how do you describe that? A mixture. A mixture beast.
A lion with wings.
What?
This looks like a lion.
A lion with wings, okay. Yeah, usually a cow. Yeah, you're right, actually. This one is a cow. Some are more liony. Liony. Feline. But the idea is there's a mixture. They do have wings, and they are guardians. And so God told Moses to weave a picture of kruvim in the tabernacle on these linens.
So and they were sort of guardians.
Angelic guardians.
Angelic guardians, aren't they?
That's right. And they were known in other cultures too to be angelic guardians. So
what we said last time is they're not Renaissance fat and chubby babies.
That's right. The other thing we see in Ezekiel, God gives her a nose ring, earrings, and a crown, and also bracelets, smidim. Who in the Bible received the gift nose ring and bracelets?
Rebecca.
In what context? Why did he give her these gifts?
She was the one.
Like a betrothed.
She was the one. It was kind of an engagement. So here, when God is giving this young girl Israel these gifts, he is getting engaged to her. He's saying, we are going to get married. And so he gives her these fancy gifts. And these are also the gifts we talked about, the golden calf. Do you remember what the people took out to make the golden calf?
Earrings, golden
it was
earrings.
Earrings and nose rings and any leftover bracelets. Because they'd already given offerings for the tabernacle. So what gold is left over? Their jewelry. So she has all these jewelry. It also mentions, what is she eating? Finest flour. And that's interesting because this solet, this word for fine flour, is what many of the flour-based offerings are made of. It says solet. It's not just your regular flour. It's
like cake flour, you know, something finer.
Something
brown.
Finer. Their equivalent in that time. So
there's a modern word, solet.
Solet today is not your fine flour. It's your cream of wheat flour. You can make a porridge out of it.
Oh, that's right. Well, they make porridge.
I don't know. I didn't follow that word to see where it, how it progressed that way.
It's semolina.
Semolina, that's right. Today, solet is semolina.
Every hospital.
But in ancient days, it was the finest, the best flour. Presumably the lightest, I don't know. Now, honey is not for sacrifice, but God did promise to Israel a land of milk and honey. And he promised to feed them honey from the rock and also oil from the rock. So maybe that those two images are put together, where you've moved from the tabernacle imagery to the promised land imagery and combine them together, because they are both signs of a covenant with God. Right? God gave the tabernacle when he gave his covenant, and he also gave the promised land based on his covenant with the people. Okay, and then you notice, like we mentioned, in verse 13 of Ezekiel, you see that she is so pretty, she becomes royalty. And we talked about these things being suitable for temples and royalty. So if you follow this metaphor, you have Israel as a nation being given these things by God. They're given a covenant. They're given this tabernacle. They're given a land. And now they take all the blessings God has given, and what do they do with it?
Prostitute themselves.
Okay, they become a prostitute. So if you follow the metaphor, what does that mean?
Well, it says false gods, but you make gods.
Okay, they start worshiping false gods. And what are some of the ways the people in this land worshipped other gods? What did that mean?
Apostasy.
But describe it. What kind?
Pray to some structure. Pray to an object.
Okay, it gives you a hint here.
They make idols.
What exact idols did they make?
Male sexual idols.
Male idols. Okay, male images.
Male idols.
Male images. There was a big fertility cult here. So to guarantee fertility, you want children, right? Because your economy depends on workers. You need children. You want rain, because this land does not have many rivers. You need rain. And so how do you guarantee? These are out of human control. How do you guarantee many children? How do you guarantee rain? Well, if you ask a Canaanite, they say, You pray to the god of rain. You pray to the god of fertility. Or you enact in sexual relations in a temple to try to gain favor with a god and give fertility.
And you offer fragrant incense.
And so all across this land, it talks about in Jeremiah, many prophets, it talks about any raised hill. Anywhere that's kind of lifted up, they would set up what they call a bama. Today it's a stage. But then it was a cult, a place of idol worship. But you're not bowing down to an idol. That's not what's going on. You're going there and you're sleeping with somebody to try to guarantee fertility. You might also burn some incense. You want good crops. You bring some flour and you burn some incense.
So that the high places were not going to worship or burn or,
No, there was worship involved, but a lot of it was fertility worship, where you actually sleep with a temple prostitute to guarantee your fertility. It's part of a ritual.
So what we're saying on these high hills, that they did have fertility temples or
yes.
some sort of shack
yes.
or whatever, tent.
And they would presumably also be using some of these materials.
Right.
So here the metaphor mixes a little bit with reality, where God is saying, look what you're doing. You're trying to secure your fertility, secure your reign by going out and engaging in pagan practices. And you've taken all the good stuff I've given you for the right way to worship, and you've converted it and given it to the wrong way. And he's using this imagery because it actually lines up with fertility. It's an easy way to talk about it by saying you're being unfaithful, because they really are being unfaithful. And it shows like the true husband is the Lord. And these fertility cults are all these, you know, any passerby, just anyone. And so God can highlight not only the breaking of the covenant, but the shame and the total lack. How could you not see what you're doing? It's so terrible. But again, this is the culture around them. This is what everybody else says you do. If you want rain, this is what you need to do. So there's a strong cultural pressure. And from our day and age, it's easy to look back and say, well, how could you not get that? But we are not in that culture, and so we don't understand the pressure involved.
But we understand exactly the pressure when we go off and find our own answers to whatever the issues
well, we
are.
Can,
God has
right.
given us a place, the place where he dwells.
Once we extrapolate to our context,
yeah.
we can find similar things that would be pressuresome in our society. But you have to make that jump. You have to interpret what it was for them then, and then find the same thing what it is for us now. Because I don't have a pressure. I feel no pressure to go bow down to an idol. I feel no pressure to go sleep with a priest to guarantee fertility. I can buy flour in a store. It's just not the same pressure. If it doesn't rain, fine. I have some water pipes I can turn on. It's like the same pressure is not there for that exact category. But we need to find other things in our society that are similar lures away from depending totally on God. And so it takes some work to think about those. But it's these images, these materials are the things that connect the two passages and help you understand one in light of the other.
If God's tabernacle or temple is one of the only temples in the region that sex wasn't happening at, you can see how people would have thought it was boring.
Yeah. It would stand out as very different.
And I was thinking that temple prostitute was like a side activity that happened because of pagan rituals and the orgy or something, whatever. But it was actually the main part of it.
It was a main part of it,
and
yes.
And you had sex with a temple
yeah.
person.
And you go to the temple to find those people.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's an act that happens at the temple precinct. They would have side rooms. You know, it's very much part of the standard way of worshiping these
so
foreign gods.
Is that what Jacob did?
Well, he calls her a kdesha. He calls her a temple prostitute because that was considered higher status than just a regular prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
So he does it more to save face, I think, with other people.
But essentially, yes.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Tamal didn't work for a temple.
Practice, it wasn't part of the regular God's temple, or was it?
No, it wasn't. Not part of the regular.
So for him to say that is also false gods.
Sure. But in
he's trying to justify it.
In Judah's day.
I was trying to justify that.
Right.
In Judah's day, there is no temple set up yet. There is no tabernacle yet. So there hasn't been a definitive, this is how you're supposed to do it.
Established rules.
Now, because Purim is almost coming, does anybody see a connection to Esther? Okay, there's beautiful queens. How about this? How about this? Let's find the verse. Okay, I'm reading from Esther, chapter 1. It talks about the king and all his great wealth. He displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his majestic greatness for a lengthy period of time, 180 days to be exact. When those days were completed, the king then provided a 7-day banquet for all the people who were present in Shushan, the capital, for those of highest standing to the most lowly. It was held in the court located in the garden of the royal palace. The furnishings included linen, purple, that's this argaman, purple curtains hung by cords of the finest linen. Here it's boots, by the way. It's the same stuff as shesh. It's just using a later word. What else? Wool on silver rings. So we have silver rings. Alabaster columns. That's a little different. Gold and silver couches displayed on a floor made of valuable stones of alabaster, mother pearl, and mineral stone. Drinks were served in golden containers on which differed from one another. Royal wine was available in abundance at the king's expense. There were no restrictions on the drinking. Okay. So some of those very things, gold and silver, the fine linen, and argeman, are listed.
And if you want to go on with the comparison,
mm-hmm.
then you've got the whole Vashti story. When
being
she's
a queen.
Really dancing or being asked to dance and behave like some, not exactly a temple prostitute, but not far off. She's being asked to make a show of herself, isn't she?
Right. And there is there are traditions about Vashti being called to wear the crown. Remember, God also gives a crown. Now, a crown wasn't always just for royalty. It could also be for a bride's getting married. It was just a beautiful, fancy headgear. So here, it's probably part of her wedding dress or something, where in Vashti, she is actually royalty. I'm trying to find the verse, though. In the end of the book of Esther, I should have found my verse for you. Esther isn't that long, but when you're trying to scan it, it's longer than you remember.
What's the context?
The context, okay, the king gives Mordechai his signet ring in chapter 8. But he also gives him some other things. He dresses him. Yeah, what verse are you reading?
15.
Of chapter 8? Okay, so look there. Esther 8, verse 15.
He was wearing royal garments. It actually says royal garments. Blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen.
Okay, so let's look at those things. Sorry, my text just keeps going back and forth on me. We have an example of hard copy being better than computers. It just
Yay.
Keeps jumping. Yay. Can you read those slowly again?
So when this is verse 15.
Verse 15
8.
Of chapter 8 of Esther.
When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen.
Okay, the blue and white is Tchelet. The purple is Argeman. And he's got a gold ring from the king. Was silver mentioned there? The white was also probably Shesh or Boots, either one. So, in a sense, in the book of Esther, you see a reversal. You start off, this whole fancy description is describing what? The king's palace, the Persian kingdom. This is the Persian kingdom is showing off. This is how great we are. This is our wealth. And then at the end, those same materials are given to Mordechai, the Jew, the foreigner. And so you see a reversal. What started, what was the symbol of greatness for Persia, is now transferred to Mordechai. And it's these same elements. So you see this reversal in the book of Esther. And you see it not just in the story, but also in what the characters are wearing. Because what started out palace decorations is now decorating Mordechai himself. It's as if he is becoming king, even though he's not really king, but he's being promoted to almost king. But you definitely feel, because you can see these elements, you feel the impact of this power and wealth that is being taken away from one, put on another.
Hey, you can make an enormous parallel. If you go back to Exodus,
mm-hmm.
you have this amazing dwelling place, the tabernacle,
right,
where God says he's going to dwell, and where God is going to speak from, and so on, with all the wealth. And then this same amazing wealth, that's the only word I can think of, gets put on Israel, or Jerusalem, it actually says in Ezekiel.
Yeah, Jerusalem, that's right.
It gets put onto Jerusalem. And then Jerusalem basically abuses it.
Mm-hmm.
And
probably specifically Jerusalem, because that's where the temple is set up,
yes,
right? And so then they abuse that.
Well, they abuse it. And I mean, the lesson surely is exactly the same. Whatever we get given, the most amazing wealth, those of us who know the Lord, those of us who understand the work of the Holy Spirit, whatever it is, we get given this amazing wealth. We're clothed in robes of righteousness, Isaiah says,
mm-hmm,
and all the clothing that we have. And so often we abuse it.
We go off to other things.
We worry about this. We rush off to lawyers. We argue with our neighbors. Whatever it happens to be, we, both as individuals, but as the church, can actually prostitute itself in exactly the same way.
Sure, definitely. If you remember here, the sin was that she started trusting in her beauty.
Right.
And using her beauty for her own means.
Yeah.
Instead of realizing that even that beauty was from God.
Well, it connects very strongly in my brain with it's Proverbs 5. It's written about people who take you don't choose the true, and you probably you go for the false things, and then you pay to the someone who didn't own it, and it's exactly written verse by verse what is happening here in Ezekiel.
Yeah.
As we lost the true, and what the consequences are, you know.
Right.
When your flesh and body are consumed, and you say, "Ahoy, hate the discipline."
Say your reference again is Proverbs 4?
Proverbs 5.
Proverbs 5.
The lips of the adulterous woman drip honey.
Yeah.
And
it's the same.
Yeah.
Her speech is smoother than oil. I mean, here she's been given honey and oil.
Yeah.
And so the adulteress there is both just a regular adulteress and also a symbol of kind of foreign worship, because there's such a big metaphor in the Bible of God marrying his people.
Right.
He is the husband. And so to leave God is to commit adultery. It's putting it in a picture that we as people can understand from our society, because nobody thinks adultery is a good thing. And so you understand what you're doing to God, who is invisible, by what you can see in society and the real consequences that you see in society when people do this. Also, there are some passages, we don't have much time, but we talked about the parochet, is that curtain that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies, right? And this was meant to be the work of an embroiderer, and probably has some of these guys woven in there. The kuvim. So this is also an image. I noticed this time reading that the kaporet is the cover that goes on the ark, and it has the two kuvim facing each other on the ends. So two of these on the ends facing each other. Did you notice that you don't put the cover on until the ark comes into the Holy of Holies?
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't.
Which, by the way, Holy of Holies is a Hebrew way of saying the holiest place, mm-hmm, right? Like Song of Songs is the best song. We have in the Bible Song of Songs. Or King of Kings is the greatest king. Lord of Lords, the biggest, greatest Lord. So it's an idiom. So Holy of Holies is the holiest place. So when the Ark of the Covenant comes in, then you put this covering on it. So I don't have an answer, but I was wondering, what do you make of that? Why would you wait to put the cover on till it goes in the holiest place?
That connection of the dressing before the king, but otherwise it doesn't get at all.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Again,
you take it off or something.
Inside this box, the ark, we call Ark of the Covenant. Ark is Old English for a chest or a box that you put things in.
A cupboard.
A cupboard. So we have, what do we have in there?
The Ten Commandments.
The manna. Aaron's budding staff. That's right. But the main thing is the Ten Commandments, because they are the copy that sealed the covenant between God and Israel. So, I don't know. I was thinking maybe it has to do with something that's inside the ark that kind of seals. Once it's in the holiest place, like it's in the presence of God. Kind of like where you both, when you sign something, what you're signing is that you've both seen these documents and you're agreeing to it. It's kind of like a final agreement. And then the cover goes on. And really the cover of that ark is considered God's throne. Many psalms talk about God speaking from between the kuvim.
Yeah.
So you got a kuv on one side and a kuv on the other, and right in the middle there is God's presence. And of course, now it's in the Holy of Holies, so that's where God's presence is concentrated so strongly that people have to be stopped from going in there by this curtain. And of course, what does a curtain do in the Gospels? How do we have mention of this curtain?
It's ripped in two when the Lord died.
It's split when Jesus dies.
Well, is it when he dies? Yes, when he dies.
When he dies, it's split.
Yes, it's split.
In Matthew 27:51, just then the temple curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks were split apart. In Mark 15:38, and the temple curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. Luke 23:45, the temple curtain was torn in two.
It's interesting that it's from top to bottom.
It's
not man who rips it up.
It's got to be God. That's
God,
right.
Who has to make a way in.
It would be very hard to rip this curtain. It's very thick,
Yeah. Full
of embroidery. So, yeah, that's got to be God there already. I think it would be very hard just to hold the curtain as a human. I think it took many people, because cloth becomes very heavy when it's thick. But then in Hebrews, we also have mention of this curtain. In Hebrews 6:19, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul, sure and steadfast, which reaches inside behind the curtain. So our hope reaches all the way to the holiest place. It gives us access to that. In Hebrews chapter 9:3, and after the second curtain, there was a tent called the Holy of Holies. That's just mentioning this tabernacle structure. But if you look in chapter 10 of Hebrews, verse 20, it's talking about Jesus. By the fresh and living way that he inaugurated for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh. So there we have the exact parallel of Jesus' body broken is like the curtain being ripped. And so there's a living way. Now you have access to this holiest place through Jesus' holiness, even though we are all still, on many ways, living as humans, which means we are mostly unholy. Even the high priest, right, who's set aside to be holy, he can't just go into the Holy of Holies any time. It's one day a year, and he has to go through all these purification rituals. So, by definition, being human is not being holy. But through Jesus' holiness, we have access to the presence of God, basically, which is found in its most concentrated form in the Holy of Holies. Again, we've also discussed here in weeks past how God doesn't need a temple, right? He can be anywhere. And we are his temple. But really, people needed a temple. The people needed a temple, and God knew that. And so he gave them detailed instructions of how to do it. and how not to do it. Don't do the fertility. Don't have rooms on the side where women are waiting to sleep with you. That's not the right way. And so some ways look the same. He's using the same ingredients. They have the same guardian, Kulvim. But other things, you better not even touch that.
It's interesting the idea that God doesn't need it, doesn't necessarily want to do it. And I kept thinking of the whole thing about Saul. They asked for a king. I didn't want to give you a king. I wanted to be king over you. But seeing as you ask, you'll discover what problems lie ahead.
Right.
It's the same principle, actually. I don't need a temple. You could say, we don't need churches and buildings and cathedrals.
Right. But that's part of God's grace. There are many things that God doesn't need, but we need.
That's
because
right.
We can't be better than human. We aren't perfect in our wisdom and knowledge and understanding of God. And so he comes and meets us where we need it. And so if he says we need it, then we better do it because we need it. And if God had come and made a covenant with us today in our world, maybe he wouldn't have built a temple. I don't know. Maybe there would have been a different way. But he did come in history and he set up the temple. And once he did that, we have a temple.
But didn't he talk to Moses about the temple on the mountain? Because
yes.
All what he built was what he told him on the mountain as
right.
he saw.
Yeah, the tabernacle, not the temple.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about tabernacle.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
It's the same.
It's the same.
Yeah.
You're right.
And because it's the... Well, I mean, I think you think that he did this because we think we as a human, we need to have a place.
Yeah.
I think so.
Because he also gave Moses laws on the mountain.
Yeah.
And one of those laws says, if you have a slave and this happens and you need to correct the slave... You may beat him, but he must be able to recover in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
If the slave dies, you're guilty.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Why did God give that law? I personally think slavery is wrong. But I think that God knew in the people's understanding at that time in history, nobody had this concept that slavery was wrong. Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of the economy. It was just the way things worked. It's like we go to the water and turn on the water. That's just how it happens. And so if you're in that context, then he gives you what you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to have a slave, you have to at least treat them somewhat humanely. You can't just kill them like they're your property, where other people could. They were just money. Oh, you kill one slave, just buy another. God is saying, no, that's still a person. And you still have to treat them like one. So when you compare... God's law is leading them to see a higher vision. And eventually, you know, we get to Paul, there's no slave or free. Like in God's eyes, you're all the same. You're not born a slave, you're born a human. And it's human structures that make someone slave or not slave.
Yeah, but
in God's eyes, everybody's human, everyone is equal.
In Paul's day, there were still slaves. And he's still telling them. And the slaves have got to respect their masters.
He did say, slaves respect your masters. Why? To lead them to the Lord.
Yeah.
Not because slavery is a good way. But if you can get your freedom, go ahead. See, there's a difference there. What is his motive for saying, respect your master? You want to do what is considered just in your society so that you can lead others to God. And then eventually, you know, if there's a way for freedom... Between God and you, you know that you're not a slave and that you should be free. But, you know, go there slowly so that you can win people to the Lord. And that's that you can see this principle in many areas. We don't have time to go into all of them. But so that's what I mean by God meeting humans where they're at and drawing them higher and giving them rules that will glorify him in their time and culture. And so the principles are eternal. The specifics may change from culture and time to culture and time. But our worship service is about to start downstairs. So Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
And please join us downstairs.
I remember some famous theologian, I think, years and years ago, his phrase was, God meets.